Italy's old nemesis returns, political instability. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. It is Monday, the 10th of December. I'm Jeff Horwich. You probably thought we forgot about little old Italy, what with all this business about Greece and Spain, but this morning the boot is back in the headlines. Plus, we've got a veritable cornucopia of important Democrats talking about the fiscal cliff, by which I mean two of them. Republicans, you can return our calls anytime. And Santa, if you're listening, best keep your hatred of the Toronto Maple Leafs to yourself.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti plans to resign, and there will be elections early in 2013. Monti, you might recall, was supposed to lead a government of nonpartisan experts who could steer the country out of its fiscal crisis. But his efforts have lost the critical support of the party last in control, still headed by former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. From our European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is here with me. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
It's been a little over a year since Monti took over. Has he been able to achieve much?
Well, he's brought some stability back to Italy. He's cut the budget deficit. The government's borrowing costs have come down. The crisis has abated, but at a cost. He's doled out a lot of austerity. Unemployment has risen. Living standards have fallen. Monti certainly isn't as popular as he was a year ago.
So is Monti, are his technocratic ways out of the picture now?
Well, we don't know, really. I mean, he could decide to run in the general election, which has now been brought forward to February. And if he won, he would then have a real mandate. He could continue as a technocrat. He could just stand back and see whichever parties win most votes in the election, see if they want him again as an unelected technocrat. The situation is very fluid.
And this does raise the specter of the colorful, scandal-plagued Silvio Berlusconi standing for election again, trying to nab a fourth term. What are his odds?
Well, to some extent, he is a busted flush. His party has only 14% support. He's widely regarded as a sort of somewhat discredited figure because of his many legal battles. But he remains a powerful figure. His critics say he has the power to stall any hopes of recovery in Italy. James Walston at the American University of Rome claims that Berlusconi's candidacy is not good for the Italian economy.
What it doesn't need is political instability, and Berlusconi's return has certainly raised that specter again, that Italy will be ungovernable.
He says it's most unlikely that Berlusconi would be re-elected, but his campaign could certainly create a lot of uncertainty and concern for investors.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thanks very much.
Okay, Jeff.
And let's do the numbers. Markets have been pretty solidly up so far this morning. As I'm speaking at this moment, the Dow is up about 0.25%, sitting around 13,188. The S&P 500 is up just a touch, and the NASDAQ is up about 0.4%. We'll see what the day holds. Export growth from China slowed sharply last month, although consumers in China were buying more. McDonald's has been a useful way to chart the downturn in the global economy lately, but Mickey D's today turned in something of a November surprise, a 2.4% rise in sales, helped partly by lowering prices in Europe. And one of the big business stories of the summer was Standard Chartered, a British bank that admitted hiding hundreds of millions of dollars of transactions with Iran and other countries in violation of U.S. sanctions. Today, Standard Chartered has agreed to pay more than $300 million to resolve those charges. And before we plunge into the snake pit that is fiscal cliff negotiations, here's one more slick item. If you find yourself needing to pull in a little extra cash after the holidays, it is not too late to sign up for python hunting. Evidently, 12-foot-long Burmese pythons, the legacy of former pets that were turned loose, have become a major invasive pest in the Everglades. Last year, officials bagged almost 300 of these snakes. So, in January, Florida's Python Challenge will award $1,500 to the person who can bag the most pythons in a one-month period. All it takes is a $25 entry fee, a 30-minute training course, and, of course, that little something extra that is the reason most of us choose not to hunt pythons in the swamp.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
The lines of communication remain open. You can look for more glimmers of hope at the start of another week of fiscal cliff talks, but that's as much official optimism as the key players in Washington can offer this morning. One of those players is Democrat Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. He's the ranking member on the House Budget Committee. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
The Democrats are, of course, in the minority in the House. So what's your role in this negotiation process?
Well, the House Democrats actually have a very important role in this process, because most people suspect that when an agreement comes to the House of Representatives, it's going to need a big chunk of Democratic votes in order to pass. And that's because it's highly unlikely that many of the Tea Party Republicans will support any agreement that's reached. And so that means that House Democrats have an important role to play in these negotiations.
Is there any worry that you have about a compromise coming your way that is so unpalatable to you that Democrats in the House would vote against it?
Well, I'm confident that the president will get an agreement that takes a balanced approach to long-term deficit reduction, meaning a mix of additional revenue from high-income earners, but also some additional cuts. And the overall deal should reflect the views expressed by the American people at the ballot box on these issues.
You would agree with your Republican colleagues that we have to find ways to control the future costs of entitlement programs, especially Medicare, and make those more sustainable, right?
Yes. The difference is how we go about doing that.
Right. How would you articulate the fundamental difference that exists at this point between the parties on Medicare?
Well, the approach Democrats have recommended is to realign many of the incentives in Medicare, to move away from a strict fee-for-service system and reduce overall health care costs. And we've begun to see some progress. The Republican proposal approach to Medicare reform has been not to reduce overall costs, but simply to transfer rising health care costs onto the backs of seniors.
Republicans would say, and there is some data they can call upon to back this up, that you can't do it your way. You can't find the cost savings without changing benefits in a way that might hurt some people.
Well, if you look at the savings we made in the Affordable Care Act, not by across-the-board cuts, but by changing the incentive system so that doctors and hospitals focus more on the quality of care they provide, not simply the quantity of care. And that was $716 billion in savings. I'm feeling a little whiplashed here by the Republicans. 4 weeks ago, they were complaining that President Obama achieved too much in the way of Medicare savings. And now they appear to be complaining that he's not doing enough.
Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland is the ranking member on the House Budget Committee. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I guess when it comes to landing interviews with key folks in Congress, sometimes when it rains, it pours. So now for a different status report on the fiscal cliff, we'll turn to Democratic Senator Kent Conrad from North Dakota. He's the chair of the Senate Budget Committee for another few weeks. He's about to finish his last term after joining the Senate back in 1987. He talked earlier today with my Morning Report colleague, Jeremy Hobson. Here's Jeremy.
Well, so what's your expectation on what's going to happen here with the fiscal cliff? Will it be avoided before the end of the year?
I believe it will be. I believe the two sides are edging closer together. If you actually took the president's revenue and the proposed spending cuts the Republicans put on the table and put the two together, and with some modifications on the spending side, because I do think their health care savings are a little too robust, and another category of their spending cuts probably needs to be altered somewhat. But if you put basically the two together, you'd have a package of over $4 trillion, which most objective observers have said is what's necessary to get our debt under control.
And you're expecting that kind of a grand package to be passed before the end of the year, or is this going to come after the new year?
Well, my own belief is that you could pass a framework agreement now that would say to the committees of jurisdiction, here's how much you have to save in various categories, here's how much money you have to raise, and here's how to do it, but leave the details up to next year with some kind of fail-safe mechanism so that if they failed to do it, you'd have an assurance that the savings would actually be realized.
But then we're going to start to hear that old phrase again, kicking the can down the road.
Well, you know, we're always going to hear some kind of phrase. The harsh reality is this: you can't change the entire tax system overnight. But if you have a fail-safe mechanism that assures you that if the committees would fail for whatever reason, you'd still have an assurance of getting the savings, that wouldn't trouble me.
Now, I know that this is not something that you can pin on any one senator or member of Congress, but I have to say that looking at this from the outside, it's a little bit depressing to look at these two sides that can't work together on this, that haven't been able to over the last several years, and we're still arguing over Bush tax cuts, which are very old at this point. I mean, how can we get some optimism that this country can really move forward in a unified way?
Well, the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? It can't just be words. It has to be actions. And that's why it's so important that those who are in the middle, the sensible center, needs to hold. And they need to reach a result that's important for the country. And, you know, I'm reasonably optimistic that's going to happen.
Kent Conrad, chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, joining us from North Dakota. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Good to be with you.
A government watchdog released a report this morning on the compensation of senior staffers at Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The government-sponsored mortgage giants get credit for cutting the pay of their CEOs, but the report says other senior employees still make too much. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
There are more than 300 vice presidents at Fannie and Freddie. Their median salary is $388,000.
The president of the United States only makes $400,000.
That's Len Blum. He's a managing partner at Westwood Capital. He says Fannie and Freddie pay private sector salaries. They're not government agencies, but they were taken over by the government in 2008. Taxpayers have poured almost $190 billion into them since then. Fannie and Freddie say they need to pay competitive salaries to employees who work in a complex mortgage market. But Blum points out that Fannie and Freddie's employees make more than people working at a similar level at the Federal Reserve.
You know, it's pretty hard to argue that their counterparts at the Fed don't have all kinds of responsibility and take risk in markets and have to be well trained.
Fannie and Freddie slashed their CEO's salaries after the government takeover. The report says now there should be more oversight of senior staffers' pay. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The 2013 Super Bowl is February 3rd, still a couple months away, but companies have already bought most of the advertising minutes for the game. As usual, the pricey commercials will be dominated by big names with deep pockets. But at least one smaller company is betting big on an ad to win it new business. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
SodaStream lets you make your own soft drinks at home. In its Super Bowl ad, bottles of pop explode. Airing the commercial will cost about $3.5 million. That's about 10% of SodaStream's earnings. Some startups went bust after buying Super Bowl ads, like Pets.com. But analyst Brad Adgate with Horizon Media says,
there is a long history of advertisers who might be startups or a little bit under the radar and using the Super Bowl as a springboard to get into the consciousness of viewers.
Masterlock became a household name after its Super Bowl ad in 1974, where its padlock remained secure after being shot with a bullet. But a large audience may not transform sales for the do-it-yourself soda company. John Sisher is editor and publisher of Beverage Digest.
They are going to appeal to people who are gadget lovers, who like new kinds of equipment. I think they will be a niche player in the soft drink business.
Even if the ad is a success, Brad Adgate says most viewers forget the commercials soon after the broadcast. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wrapping things up here with a little bit of holiday cheer. A mall Santa in Toronto is out of a job after being a little too free with his opinions on sports. According to the Toronto Sun, a 3-year-old in a Toronto Maple Leafs hockey jersey climbed upon his lap for the usual routine, only to be told by Santa that his team stinks. Well, mom took her fury to Facebook, and the rest is history. In Santa's defense, last season the Maple Leafs did finish with one of the worst records in the NHL. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for today. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.